Welcome, and thank you for listening to this recording, part of the Comprehensive Opioid Abuse Program, or COPE, podcast series. COPE provides financial and technical assistance to states and units of local and Indian tribal governments to plan, develop, and implement comprehensive efforts to identify, respond to, treat, and support those impacted by the opioid epidemic. Since 2017, BJA has supported innovative work on these COPE sites across the nation. Funding and programmatic support for COPE is provided by the U.S. Department of Justice, Office of Justice Programs, Bureau of Justice Assistance, or BJA. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of the U.S. Department of Justice.
You're listening to The Power of Peers, a podcast produced by the Peer Recovery Support Services Technical Assistance Center, a project funded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance Comprehensive Opioid Abuse Program. The center is staffed by ALTARM, a nonprofit organization that creates solutions to advance health among vulnerable and publicly insured populations. I'm your host, Elizabeth Burden. Welcome to this podcast series that focuses on peer recovery supports. In 2018, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Ensuring Access to Quality Sober Living Act, marking Congress's recognition of the importance of recovery housing. In this episode, two guests join me to discuss recovery housing, what it is, how it can be an important part of efforts to address the opioid epidemic, and how municipalities and states can foster quality recovery residences. I'll be speaking with Jason Howell, Executive Director of Recovery People in Austin, Texas, and George Brock, a licensed professional counselor and clinical supervisor and co-founder of the Certified Addiction Recovery Empowerment Specialist Academy, known as the CARES Academy, a peer recovery support training. Both Jason and George are persons in long-term recovery, have experience working with and in the criminal justice system, and have served as board members for the National Alliance of Recovery Residents.
So what is recovery housing, or what are recovery residences?
Well, recovery residences is a term that the National Alliance for Recovery Residences uses to describe a continuum of recovery housing. They can go by lots of different names, anywhere from Oxford House, sober living, sober home, recovery home, therapeutic community, extended aftercare. There's lots of different names. The core or the foundation of all of them is that they're sober, safe, and peer supportive living environments that promote recovery from substance use disorders.
There was such confusion that existed in the world about what this was. Some refer to them as halfway houses, sober housing, et cetera. And so it really is about providing a family-like environment for people to learn how to live in community while learning the skills necessary to make progressive improvements in their life, or what we would generically call recovery.
So in June of 2018, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill, 4684, which defined recovery residences as a shared living environment free from alcohol and illicit drug use and centered on peer support and connection to services, including medication-assisted treatment services that promote sustained recovery from substance use disorders. What are your thoughts on that definition?
So the definition that you read gets to the importance of, you know, these are alcohol and drug-free living environments, so supporting individuals, you know, in recovery from substance use. And the foundation is this peer support, as well as, you know, getting people connected to services. I think that the most interesting thing for folks when they read this definition may be the inclusion of medication-assisted treatment, because historically, recovery housing has not always accepted individuals on opiate agonists, say like methadone or Suboxone. And there's lots of reasons for that. I think that as we start moving into an era where we're seeing more and more persons on medication-assisted treatment, we're looking to see how can recovery housing play a role in supporting them. And I'm not saying that everyone on medication-assisted treatment is an automatic fit for recovery housing, and not every recovery home is capable of supporting an individual on MAT, but we need to develop a way of advancing the recovery housing field in order to support those on medication-assisted treatment that are pursuing recovery.
MAT is probably the quintessential best practice. It's been around longer than anything else. However, it's figuring out the match between what that individual's goals are and the tools or the pathways that will work for that individual at this point in time that's really the challenge.
As individuals on MAT start gaining traction in recovery, then they can become leaders within the recovery housing movement and be supportive of that next generation of individuals on MAT moving into the various houses.
Why housing? And so this notion of social or peer, I've heard immersion in an environment that helps one recover. Why else is housing needed? Or why do recovery residents exist?
The environment that we live in can really either support or undermine our well-being. You know, a couple of things. I mean, SAMHSA identified four supportive dimensions of recovery: health, home, purpose, and community. And so, home is one of the four legs of the stool, if you will. And you know, recovery housing, we can look back to the mid 1800s when they first formed. And so, there's always been this need of individuals going and living in a recovery supportive living environment. You know, a substance use disorder, it's a chronic illness, and too often our system treats it as an acute illness. You know, somebody goes to detox, or maybe they get to go to a 30-day residential program, but then after that, they often are returning to living environments that enable their addiction. Maybe that's, you know, them returning to homelessness. Maybe they even have, you know, a home and a family to go back to, but the family doesn't know how to support them. So recovery housing, recovery residences are a place where people go to learn to live recovery. They get to find their tribe, if you will. And you know, what does it mean to be a man in recovery, a woman in recovery?
It's really about how you take people into a recovery process and actually help them feel safe and feel like they belong. And then once there's that sense of trust, the middle phase sort of is what are you doing that is contributing to the quality of our community? And then on the back end, towards the end, how are you preparing yourself to leave and sustain your progress once you leave?
Recovery residences are generally considered permanent supportive housing in that a person gets to stay there as long as they think that they need to, and as long as they're you know, furthering the support of the community.
You mentioned that there are a lot of names that housing goes by. I think a lot of folks in the community and perhaps in criminal justice are more familiar with the term halfway house. Is there a difference in your view between a halfway house and a recovery residence? And if so, what is it?
Well, so probably, yes, there is a difference. And therapeutic community is another term that is often used within the context of criminal justice. And the challenge I have with halfway houses is, well, so it's ambiguous. Does that mean halfway in or halfway out? I kind of like to talk about things in terms of their goal. And halfway is just not really the goal. It's a step in a process. So halfway houses tend to be more oriented around individuals learning how to step either from complete freedom into a more structured environment that corrects whatever challenges they were facing, so that hopefully they wind up going back into the community. Whether that's on the front end of the criminal justice system's process or on the back end, it does matter, because if a person's been institutionalized, then obviously that transition from that culture into a freedom-based culture can really be challenging. So it's a recovery residence can serve either of those purposes depending on the nature of the culture that exists within the recovery rate. So, in other words, it's kind of birds of a feather flock together sort of thing. So if you're living with people who are willing to understand your current situation and the challenges that you face, and they're supportive of where you want to go, I don't think whatever name you call it is all that relevant. But that, to me, is what distinguishes a halfway house, which is more about go to work, pay your bills, meet the conditions of supervision, and if you earn the right, you may then transition, hopefully, back into community, as opposed to a recovery residence that really puts a premium on your personal development and building on strengths and abilities and talents and passions in a way that contributes to the life of the people that you're living with in the residence itself, as well as with a view towards what you're going to do as you transition out of the recovery residence.
Processes you described to me, you've also mentioned a family-like. I'm wondering, how do those processes or the philosophies and values that underlie them square with the general aims of the criminal justice system?
The criminal justice slant in the United States focuses on the glass being half full. Here are the deficits, here are the risk factors that we've got to address in order to reduce the likelihood of new crime being committed by this individual. Whereas on the other side, the glass is half full. So what strengths and skills and abilities and talents and passions does the person walk in the door with that, if we support, will actually lead to the same outcomes that are desired on the other side, looking at it from a deficit approach, to really bolster the person's sense of agency as they make the transformation from being someone who was an addict to someone who is a person in long-term recovery. And that is a parallel process to the transformation that occurs from being a citizen to being what we call pejoratively an offender, to being, again, a citizen. And it's that crime assistance process and the recovery process that are parallels in terms of the person's self-identity, and focusing on that process, I think, is where we're able to blend the two so that it's not either or, but we have to address the concerns of both the criminal justice system as well as the safety and health of the community from the individual's perspective.
How do you think recovery residences help to blend those two views, if you will, or philosophies?
This is a challenge. I won't act like this is easy to do, but it's the authoritative approach of the criminal justice system being worked with, not against, but being worked with, so that what we're teaching people is how to manage their own transitions. And that peer support, that mutual support model, has to take into consideration the context of the person's life. So yes, you were convicted of a crime, there are expectations on you to do certain things to repair the damage from that crime, and then there's other collateral consequences that probably don't have anything to do with your rehabilitation, but can be really important to your sense of value and worth to the community that you're trying to get back into. So the recovery residence is a perfect place to address all of those needs. So you've got the individual level needs for development, and you've also got the community's need for reparation. And it's that dynamic mix of focusing, yes, on your development as a person, but also your development as someone who has to be accountable and responsible, A, for the damage that you caused, and B, for the behaviors that will allow your community to really feel like they can trust you and invest in you to the point where you live through the negative consequences of the stigma and discrimination by showing that you're able to persist in pro-social behavior.
What does a quality recovery residence look like or feel like or operate like?
We can talk about what it looks like, and we have a NAR standard that lays out the specific certification criteria, everything from having a standardized set of policies and procedures that address everything from the safety of the environment to the types of services that are provided. And NAR has defined four levels of recovery residence, from level one being totally peer run, where the best example of that is Oxford House. There's no outside authority per se that manages the house. It's done by the peers themselves. They pay their bills. They manage both conflicts and celebrate successes. It's all done by the residents themselves. All the way up to a level four, which is more of a clinically managed program, where typically you have clinical staff who are licensed or certified who operate the program. And so the variations between one and four inform what you look for in terms of, is this a safe and sober place for people to live? And so the NAR standard lays that out according to those four levels.
The standards were pulled from regional organizations that had been certifying recovery residences for several years. And so once the national standards had best practice standards were formed, then state organizations, state affiliates associated with the National Alliance for Recovery Residences could go and provide a good housekeeping seal on particular homes. And I think that empowers communities to know whether the recovery residents in their neighborhood is providing good quality. It empowers consumers and families and referral agents to know that, who do we refer to, who do we support. And it helps providers with what are best practices. It provides them with a roadmap. So if someone is not meeting a particular standard, it gives them an opportunity to kind of step up their game. And it's like, all right, so I've never thought about, we need to provide a good neighbor policy. And so what are good neighbor policies, and how can we improve how we interact with our local community?
So the levels just differentiate among programs. A level one is no better or worse than a level four. And it's not about everybody trying to become a level four. There are really good recovery residences at each of those levels. And it's just a matter of what's the vision, mission, and values of that recovery residence that determines which level they operate at. So, again, it's not about one being a lower level than level two and four is the best. It's based upon the person's recovery capital, as well as the symptom severity that they're experiencing, and what's available in the community determines what's the appropriate match at any point in time between an individual and the recovery residence.
There's also, I would think, in the community this notion that there has to be someone with a medical background in charge for a site to really be of quality. How would you respond to that?
No. I think that clinical services need to be available. I mean, that definitely is a resource within our community. But when you look at how people recover and what supports them in the long run, I mean, this is a life journey for individuals. It's, the evidence points to peer support and the non-clinical recovery support services. So they're more cost effective. It's something that can be provided over an extended period of time. Whereas the clinical services, that is best served when somebody, their symptoms have exacerbated or they're in crisis. Well, then absolutely, we get them connected with those more intensive services. They happen to be more expensive services. And so individuals receive those for the duration of the need. But then afterwards, they need to get connected with this ubiquitous, lifelong peer support, which is really what supports long-term recovery.
Why aren't there more of them, do you think, to address the housing needs of persons in recovery across the country?
Well, I think the two biggest barriers are, one, funding, and two, stigma. You know, historically, recovery housing has been self-funded. And so one of the reasons why we see so many level ones and level twos is because those are typically priced at a point where individuals can, you know, be working at a Home Depot or a Starbucks or a grocery store, and that salary would generate enough, you know, income for them to pay their way. That's not to say that individuals don't need a higher level of support sometimes, like level threes and fours, but there's not any funding streams that supplement that. I should say not any. There are very few funding streams that have supplemented that in order to get people connected to the level of support that they want. The other big thing is the stigma piece. We call them NIMBYs, not in my backyard. I spend a significant amount of my time helping educate individuals that, as a person in recovery from substance use, I meet the civil rights definition of disabled, which is a protected class along with race, color, religion, gender, family status, and national origin. And so a local and state government trying to regulate my housing choice solely based on my disability, which happens to be, you know, recovery from substance use, is no different than if the local or state government went in and was trying to regulate my housing choice based on the color of my skin or what church I go to. So because of the stigma, we see a lot of this NIMBYism trying to drive recovery housing out of neighborhoods. I always found it ironic that, you know, neighbors may be upset that a recovery home is moving into their neighborhood, and you're guaranteed that that home is actually not using illicit substances, when statistically you know that there are, you know, other households in that neighborhood that, you know, people are struggling in the addiction and are using substances illicitly, or, you know, their embrace of a, you know, a fraternity house, you know, moving next door, but not a recovery home. And I'm not trying to beat up on fraternity houses too much. I actually lived in a recovery house during college, and I know, and I also have lived in recovery homes. And if, as a property owner now, I can tell you I would much rather be living next to the recovery home.
What steps do you think recovery residents, owners, operators can take to better serve the criminal justice system, if you will, and individuals involved in criminal justice system?
Number one, spend time learning about the processes and the variables that matter to the criminal justice world. So I think it's important to be able to speak both behavioral health language as well as criminal justice language. I'll give you an example. All criminal justice systems in the United States, they operate on a risk, need, and responsivity approach, meaning we assess people's risk for reoffending, we assess the needs that are causing the criminal behavior, and then we respond to those needs in a way that hopefully promotes crime desistance, although that term is not used in the United States.
Resources are very scarce, and recovery residents typically don't make a lot of money, and so the kind of owner-operator doesn't have a lot of bandwidth to network and you know, invest the time it takes to collaborate with, you know, whether it be your judges or parole or probation or any of the various jurisdictions that you mentioned. And then in level ones and twos, there's not a lot of additional staff that would be filling those roles. And so I think that there's an opportunity for us to look at how do we increase the capacity of recovery residents to even reach out and be seen as a viable partner from their perspective.
Jurisdictions, you know, law enforcement, courts, probation, parole, how those kinds of entities can support or collaborate with recovery residences. What's the history of that in your view, and what are opportunities for the future, if you will?
Well, I think there's huge opportunities. We live in a world that is so fragmented, so I'm a huge fan of, you know, the more collaboration, you know, the better. And there are some great examples of recovery residences that have been working with, you know, diversion court judges or parole and probation. We just need to see, you know, so much more of it. A lot of times we see the criminal justice system, when they think of housing, they're thinking of halfway housing. And I've seen even, you know, them want to contract with a recovery resident and buy, you know, X number of beds. So, you know, I want to buy, you know, two of your beds, and, you know, as we'll refer an individual to your house and they can stay there for 3 months. And then after that, they need to be moved out because we want to make room for another person discharging from the criminal justice system to go into that recovery residence. And that can really undermine the whole social model. I mean, the point of individuals moving into recovery residence is to get them to stay. they should stay there as long as they want. There's evidence to show that if they stay for at least 6 months, that that's a tipping point for them. It really increases their self-efficacy, which is linked to long-term recovery outcomes. And then if they stay even longer, they become that next generation of leader within the home. So when the next person is moving in, you have some kind of seasoned leadership to assimilate them into this life of recovery. Some other barriers, I think there becomes sensitivity around background checks, and you can't have peer staff that have a particular criminal justice record, or there's this 10 year, or even worse, 20 year look back, and that doesn't understand recovery residences. I mean, you know, if an individual, the irony is somebody with a particular, you know, criminal record might be the very peer leader you would want, you know, operating a recovery residence that would be, you know, hopefully congruent to the reentry population. And also this kind of moving past the concept of placement into recovery residence. We need to find a way of being able to assess an individual, whether it be their interest in moving in a recovery home or their fit. How do we support choice rather than, you know, a judge saying you have to move into this recovery residence, or, you know, your probation or parole officer saying you have to move into this particular recovery residence, and so the individual is doing it not by choice or because that is in support of their recovery goals, but just to kind of check the boxes and move on. That can undermine the social model. And so kind of looking at that, and I think, you know, the criminal justice system has a, you know, a lot of leverage. It helps open the windows of recovery, if you will. But there needs to be this balance of, if an individual really doesn't want to move in a recovery home, then a recovery home is not the right fit for them.
So you are the high elected official of some jurisdiction for the day, and you have the power to enact three things that would make a difference for criminal justice-involved individuals in recovery residences. What are the three things that you would focus on?
Interesting question. I think the first thing I would do is look at the environments in which we're living and address those factors that are contributing to the pull of criminal behavior. And that gets to changes in living conditions, the quality of living conditions. It gets to access to education and employment. It gets to the human services that will help people avoid coming into contact with the criminal justice system. So in community psychology, we talk about primary prevention. So that would be the first focus. And then secondly, really help to figure out who are the champions in our communities for which the crime assistance process has occurred, and go and ask those people what helped you, and do more of that. And then thirdly, I would align funding as well as service priorities according to that what works that you learned about from the community itself.
Well, I think, you know, we've kind of talked about the three generally, but just to name them, we need to figure out the funding mechanism, because if we don't find the funding that's going to support the, you know, capacity expansion, the infrastructure development around recovery residences that are, you know, reentry capable, then that capacity is likely not going to be there. So it's infrastructure development, which can include training, technical assistance, as well as, you know, housing vouchers for individuals, at least initially, until you get them, you know, employed and starting to pay their way. We need to look at how do we address the NIMBYism, the not in my backyard, the stigma, and I would say that's even more intense for housing that supports or that accepts individuals with, you know, a criminal record, especially some types of criminal records. I know when I advocate, that's the first thing that people want to start talking about, and there's really looking at, we don't want, you know, individuals with those criminal records in our neighborhoods. And so there's got to be some stuff invested around, you know, changing that mindset and really protecting the rights of, you know, integrating people back into the community. And then let's see, those are the two. I think part of the solution also needs to be, how do we support the collaboration between the recovery residence community and the criminal justice system, so there can be better collaboration, better understanding of one another, and really create this recovery-oriented relationship between the two systems, because there's opportunity there. And recovery housing, recovery residences can be a big part of reducing recidivism. I think the criminal justice, when somebody engages into the criminal justice system, it becomes an opportunity to get them help. And I think that, the system also oftentimes gets frustrated because they don't know where do we get them connected with the help, because they see them, you know, individuals cycling in over and over again. And so if we can develop a better collaboration between the criminal justice system and the recovery residents, we can slow, if not stop, that recidivism cycle that happens, and really get people into happier, healthier lives, and so they, you know, can support their family and support the community.
That completes this episode. Thanks to our two guests, Jason Howell and George Brock, and thank you for listening. This podcast was brought to you by the Peer Recovery Support Services Technical Assistance Center, project funded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance Comprehensive Opioid Abuse Program and staffed by Altarum.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To learn more about how COPE is supporting communities across the nation, visit us at www.coperesources.org.
We also welcome your email at cope@iir.com.